today you have chairs specially built for tennis, which honestly, I never thought would ever happen. I didn't even know that you would even have these lightweight chairs being made like what I use for every day today is far superior to anything that we played in probably well into the 80s and it actually into the 90s. We're just wheelchair tennis players. I mean, all our tournaments were run by hospital people. They weren't run by tennis people, and that was a big thing. All of a sudden, we wanted to play on decent courts that weren't all dusty and stuff, and we wanted to have umpires, and we wanted the tournament director to be a tennis person, not some person who works at a rehab center. I can remember, like, in the early 80s, going to Eve, and I said, do you think we could do an exhibition at the U.S. Open sometime? Because we were doing exhibitions at Davis Cup matches in those days. But you think we could do one at the U.S. Open? She said, never. That'll never happen.
All right, everyone, Patrick McEnroe here. Welcome to the Tennis Worthy Podcast, brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame. I am very proud to be the president of the Hall of Fame. And I have to admit, I've waited quite a long time to be able to get the chance to sit down and talk to this man who did so much. In fact, pretty much did everything for wheelchair tennis, in addition to being the top-ranked player in wheelchair tennis throughout all of the 80s, winning multiple major titles, and winning the first ever Paralympic gold medal in doubles is the man Brad Parks, who went into the Hall of Fame in 2010. It is my pleasure and my privilege, Brad, to have you on the Tennis Worthy Podcast. Thank you.
Thank you, Patrick.
Very excited about what's happening this summer as Roger Federer will be inducted, as will Mary Carrillo, in the contributor category. We had Rick Draney, another one of the pioneers of wheelchair tennis, a couple of years ago, so I got to know him pretty well. But very honored to be able to speak to you, Brad, because you're the guy that really made this happen in wheelchair tennis, helped turn it into what it's become today, which is played in over 100 countries. So tell us about how you got wheelchair tennis off the ground at the beginning in the early 70s.
Well, about a month after I was released from rehabilitation, after my back injury, you know, spinal cord injury, I went back to have a checkup at the rehab center and just see how I was managing and everything else. And I decided to go visit some guys on the ward that I knew that were there with me. You know, there was this one guy, Kurt Kilgore, who was a Olympic volleyball player who broke his neck in Italy. He was playing professionally. And he knew I was playing tennis, and we started talking, and he asked how it was going. And I, you know, at this point, I'd, you know, been hitting, you know, for a month or so. And he said, you have to meet the new rec therapist, Jeff Minnenbreaker. And I said, I'd love to meet him. He goes, Jeff is playing tennis as well. So Jeff and I kind of hit it off immediately, and we had kind of made plans to get together, but he had come up with the idea of playing with two bounces of the ball. And, you know, I'd never even thought about that. You know, I was just going out and hitting balls from my hospital wheelchair. And so, just after that, it was probably a year later, you know, Jeff and I had become great friends at this point. And he called me up and said that, he had been teaching a class up in Los Angeles at Griffith Park for wheelchair tennis. And this is through the Parks and Recreation Department. And he said that we're going to have a tournament. And so this was the 1977, summer of 1977. And he said, what do you think about the rules? What should we do? And I said, at that point, I had decided that two bounce rule was an important part of wheelchair tennis. And, you know, now nobody has a sports chair. Jeff had made his own, so he had the closest thing to a sports chair. But so he said, what do you think? And I said, let's do two bounces, no other rules. And we did. Everything else was just tennis.
So most of the players at that point were just playing in their kind of quote unquote normal wheelchair that they use for everyday activities.
Yeah, but the normal wheelchair was literally a hospital wheelchair, like something you would see at a hospital, folded up, had the big things. Jeff had already made a lightweight aluminum chair, nothing like what you have today for everyday use. Forget the tennis chairs that are designed today. I mean, you're going, you know, but his chair, and there was a video that, or a film that was being made on his life just after I had met him. And he asked me to come, and he was going to teach me to play wheelchair tennis in this film. And the producers or the filmmakers then realized that I could play, because we started hitting, you know, just on the, as soon as we met each other, this first time we ever hit, we started hitting each other. And, but if you look at the video, it's on video, it's on YouTube. But if you look at it, you know, I'm still in a hospital wheelchair. This is, you know, months after my accident, still 1976. And he's in this custom made rough, but custom made chair. And you can see the way he moves and the way I move. And it's night and day different. And of course, today you have chairs specially built for tennis, which honestly, I never thought would ever happen. I didn't even know that you would even have these lightweight chairs being made like what I use for every day today is far superior to anything that we played in probably well into the 80s and it actually into the 90s, really. It was the 90s when the chair design really started to kind of experiment with to make them faster and quicker and all that kind of stuff. And it wasn't until probably the late 90s before a chair similar to what you see today, but it still progresses. You know, we start out with 24-inch wheels. I think they're using 27-inch wheels now, 27.5-inch wheels, I believe, which you never would have thought about. So that's, you sit higher by the time it's hard to push, but you know, if you're in, you know, and you're in shape, you just, you can go so much faster and quicker.
Yeah, it's interesting, the technology in the chairs, the technology in able-bodied tennis with the rackets, and obviously that's changed a lot for wheelchair players. But let me go back to before your accident. You were a skiing prodigy, a freestyle skiing prodigy. That's how you injured yourself, because you had an accident up at a competitive event in Utah. But did you play tennis before you had the accident?
We had an earthquake in the... Oh gosh, it would have been in the 60s. And some of the schools were damaged. And, you know, I lived in Southern California. And so as I recall, I was like around 12 years old, 11 or 12 years old. And so we were on double session. And so my parents or my mom got me into a tennis class. I don't know if you ever knew Bill Franz. He was just a young tennis instructor, and he was my first coach and learned how to play. And so I started playing tennis. Now, I never played competitively. I never even considered that. I was a surfer. I was a skier. I liked to skateboard, and I did play basketball my freshman and sophomore years in high school. But so I was never a tennis player, but I always played. I mean, I had a couple friends who liked to play. You know, parents, I would hit with my mom, you know, dad occasionally, but I had a couple guy friends who, you know, we'd just get on our bikes and we'd drive down to the junior college and we'd hit tennis balls. So I always played, and I had various lessons from Bill Franz and different people, you know, over the years. But so, yeah, I did play. So when I got hurt, some guy who was disabled came in, was telling me about wheelchair basketball. And this is probably the first month when I'm still in intensive care or just out of intensive care. And, you know, I wasn't ready to hear about that, but it made me start to think. And I always thought, God, you know, I really wanted, one of the things I wanted to do that summer. Now I'm a freshman in college. I'm competing in these ski championships and competitions. And, you know, I surfed a lot, you know, but when the waves weren't great and, you know, when it was summertime, I mean, I always wanted to be a better tennis player. I wanted to really learn how to play right and just get better from a recreational standpoint. I just like to play tennis. So that was on my mind. And so when I sit in there in the hospital, I'm like, okay, now, you know, if I end up being disabled, if I don't get better, if I don't improve, it's like, you know, could you play tennis in a wheelchair? So that was on my mind. So when I got out of the hospital, within a few weeks, we're in Indiana, and the family was playing tennis. We're at a picnic, all the cousins and the relatives. And after Dad hit, he just looked over at me and, you want to try it? And I said, yeah. So I just wheel out there. I couldn't move. I mean, I'm in this, you know, I'm weeks out of, you know, and I'm just in this big old hospital wheelchair, but I could hit some tennis balls, and he was throwing them to me. And that was it. I was kind of decided I'm going to give it a shot and see if it's possible. And then a week after meeting Jeff, it was like, okay, this is like a positive thing. And also we have this first tournament and, you know, story in itself with that, you know, meeting this great wheelchair athlete in the finals, but nobody was tennis players. You know, that first tournament, I mean, I guess I was a tennis player, but nobody else was. They were all just wheelchair athletes. They were wheelchair basketball players.
And basketball at that time was pretty popular, right? For wheelchair players. Yeah.
Yeah. It was in the Paralympics. They had racing in the Paralympics. And the guy played in the finals. You know, I asked him, I go, Dave, why did you play in that first tournament? And he goes, I just thought I was the best wheelchair athlete in the world. And I could do whatever I wanted to do and I could beat anybody. And, you know, he had a good forehand, but he had a decent first serve, but he had no second serve and he didn't have a backhand. And his wheelchair skills were amazing. He had just won that summer in the Paralympics, the 100 and the 15, and gold medal in basketball. I mean, the guy was a superstar and I admired him. I mean, he was amazing. You know, he was just this incredible athlete. And, you know, I was playing him in the finals and thankfully I beat him. But so I owe that to against him. They were great friends now. But at the time, you know, he was like this kind of superstar guy, you know.
So you, and I want to mention the other three names because it's important that we hear about them too. David Salz, Jim Wirth, Dave Kiley. And the four of you started the National Foundation of Wheelchair Tennis. Okay. And that was sort of the impetus for what has now become, you know, as I said, 150 tournaments. I think it's 41 countries now that have official tournaments, tons of prize money. When you guys got together, could you ever dream that what wheelchair tennis would have become and what it is today?
No way. I mean, I met Jim. We were extras on the film Coming Home. Do you remember that film?
Sure, I do, yeah.
With John Voight and Jane Fonda. So we're extras 10 days, and I have tennis rackets and tennis balls in my car, and I'm telling him about wheelchair tennis. He's a wheelchair basketball player. And on the set, you know, we have a break, and I take him over to a place where there was cement, and I started hitting tennis balls with him. And this was probably 77. Maybe 78, I don't know. So that's how Jim got involved, and he became interested. Dave Kiley was the guy who, you know, I played in the first tournament, this wheelchair athlete. And Dave Salz, you know, I was in college, and I got to get a phone call from this friend of mine who was hitting tennis balls with a young girl. He's disabled. They're both disabled. Hitting tennis balls at public parks in Irvine. And the pro for the city was Dave Salz. And he saw this, you know, and you know Danny. I'm sure he played with Danny Salz.
Sure, sure. I remember Danny played at UCLA, right? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So Danny, or Dave, was his older brother. And good player, good coach. And he saw this and he goes, this is amazing. We should do a big clinic and try to get people, you know, out here. And he goes, well, you need the guy, Mike Jacobs, said, well, you need to meet Brad or talk to Brad. And so he calls me up and convinces me to come down. And so we do this big clinic. And after the clinic was hugely successful. And you know, all these local people came out. And this was 1979, like December. And so we decided, you know, Dave was very encouraging. And then we both decided to include Jim and Dave Kiley. So, But Dave was a big emphasis in the early, you know, that first year or so. And then, you know, he got into music, you know, promotions and things. He went in kind of a different direction. And I just found out he passed away a couple of years ago.
Sorry.
But yeah. So we had kind of lost touch over the years. He went kind of, you know, music and I stayed with the tennis and continued to run the organization.
Well, we in the tennis world are sure lucky that you stayed with tennis. And I'm interested because, you know, I'm good friends with Cliff Drysdale, and he was part of the Handsome Eight when the tour was trying to get more power and, you know, elite players like Arthur Ashe, for example, you know, missing Wimbledon and boycotting that one year. But balancing, I mean, you pretty much did it all. I mean, you were the best player in wheelchair tennis, as I said, throughout the 80s. And at the same time, you're the lead administrator for the sport, right? So how was it to balance those two with your competitive nature, which we could obviously all see and hear, with, okay, we want to make this thing work? How do we make this thing work? And how do I still stay successful and be competitive?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was just, first of all, I was a tennis player. I wanted to see how good I could get. I wanted to be the best in the world. You know, when I lost a match to like Randy, you know, the first real player who challenged me was Randy Snow. And when, you know, when I started losing to him a few times, you know, freaked me out. And I was like, I got to get better. I remember I was hitting with or working with Vic Braden on some things. And his response when I told him, you know, what I feel like I need to do, his response was, well, just face it, Brad. He's a better tennis player than you. anyway, I did not want to hear that, of course. And I didn't believe he was, but I mean, he became, you know, one of our great, maybe at that point in time and for a few years, our greatest champion. And it did so much for wheelchair tennis. But we, it was hard. It was hard because, you know, we ran the U.S. Open at the time. We called it the National Championships. I think the international people started coming in 81 and they got bigger. And finally, we said, we can't just call this the National Championships anymore because it's international. So that's when we changed to the U.S. Open and Wheelchair Tennis Championships, and was at the Rack Club of Irvine. It was difficult. You know, we'd have this big banquet. I have all these sponsors and celebrities the night before the finals, and you know, this was my kind of project for the Open. We had, you know, we had a tournament director and everything else, but we, you know, I still pretty much, I had certain aspects, and one of the things was dealing with sponsors. And you know, so I, by the time I get to the finals, you know, I was shot, you know, I was worn out. So it was very difficult. And and then after I won the tournament in 1987, I'd won in 85 and 87. And then, you know, the board, you know, we had various people on our board and they would say, Brad, you know, it's time for you to really focus. I'm 30 years old, focus on just running the organization. And hated to hear that, but, you know, I was pretty worn out. You know, I've been competing now for about 10 years and I was feeling the stress of trying to do that. And, you know, a couple of years later, we started having children. And so, you know, I thought I was so good at that point that I didn't have to really train hard and I could still go out and be super competitive. And I was, it took a couple of years before, you know, we're training it, you know, like the 4 hours a day sort of thing. And then training to just before tournaments and things. You know, it takes a while before that affected me, but it did. And then mentally it affected me. And so, you know, I probably retired earlier, you know, really competing than I would have liked to have. And, you know, and injuries creep in because you're not really in shape. And so the injuries creep in and things. And so I probably would have quit before I was ready to. And then we were working at that point by the mid 90s, you know, we're working to develop, you know, stronger ties with, you know, the ITF and the USTA, and it's growing internationally. The Paralympics are starting to, you know, it was 88 when we had an exhibition in Seoul, and only, you know, four players went. And a lot of the top guys, you know, didn't necessarily go because, you know, it was right after our US Open and people were worn out at that point for the year. So it, 92 was kind of the big thing because then it was official. You know, it wasn't just an exhibition. And
when you play, when you won the doubles that year with Randy at the Paralympics, right?
I did. And Randy won the singles. You know, he was at the top of his game. You know, I was at the end of mine. I got to the quarters in singles, lost to a guy named Kai Schermeier, great player. I beat David Hall in the first round.
Oh, yeah. Well, he was also another all-timer. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it was a tough first round match for both of us. And he was, you know, at the early part of his, you know, the beginning of his career, I should say, and, you know, but still a formidable player. And you know, I was at the end. So it was kind of a interesting matchup. But, you know, by the time I got to the quarters, you know, the guy I played was a great player in Germany. But anyway.
You know, from when I was on the tour, it was sort of when wheelchair tennis started to become bigger and bigger in the majors in tennis. And it's, for me, it was always so cool to see the, I mean, just like it was as an able-bodied player, to see the players coming from all over the world. And that transition for you guys must have been big. And talk about that, and also about the transition from NFWT to the USTA. How did that transition come about? Was it related to the international nature of the way the game was evolving?
Yeah, probably, because a big part of it was the ITF taking the lead there. You know, that 1980, when we first started this organization, Charlie Pasterell got us involved with the Aetna World Cup at Hartford. Do you remember that event?
Sure, absolutely. I just spoke to Charlie, by the way, recently on our podcast here. So if you ever get a chance to listen, he's fascinated right around Indian Wells, because that was his vision, that amazing tournament there. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that was our first coming out with this foundation. Was I was hitting, we were on a family weekend in Palm Springs, and I'm hitting on the courts at Mission Hills. Tommy mm-hmm. Tucker is on the court next
sure.
to me.
He's still there. Still there.
Is he really? Oh, gosh. Anyway, so he watches me hit, and then he has to hit a few balls with me, and then we started talking, and I said, you know, we just formed this organization, kind of promote and do exhibitions, and Mission Hills was where the Indian Wells tournament was in those days, and I think Charlie was the tournament director or something, and, you know, and but anyway, he says, well, let me go ask Dennis Ralston. And Dennis Ralston, I think he was either just the Davis Cup captain, he might have still been, or he probably, you know, he might have still been. Anyway, so Dennis comes out and watches me and just goes, yeah, we'll let you do that. So we do this exhibition, went off really well. Bud Collins, I think, called the match. We're just wheelchair tennis players. I mean, all our tournaments were run by hospital people. They weren't run by tennis people. And that was a big thing. All of a sudden, we wanted to play on decent courts that weren't all dusty and stuff. And we wanted to have umpires. And we wanted the tournament director to be a tennis person, not some person who works at a rehab center. And so anyway, so we do this exhibition and went well. And Charlie says, you got to go to the Aetna World Cup. So he arranges for us to go to the Aetna World Cup. And so... We're there. We meet John Newcomb. We go to Australia. He's, you know, he wants me to hit tennis balls with him after his practice session. So I go and hit with him. And he goes, what would it take to get you to go to Australia? So we go to Australia, meet Brian Tobin. And then Charlie says, you got to meet Eve Kraft at the USTA. So we go to the, I guess it was the semi-annual meeting. I think it was in Florida. This is still 1980, just all that first year. And Eve just gets behind it and was really excited by wheelchair tennis, but, you know, sort of mentors me along. And, you know, eventually you meet Doug McCurdy and Henry Talbert and Clu Brewer and all these people, you know, who worked for Eve during those years. And then Doug McCurdy goes to work for the ITF. And all of a sudden, one day Doug calls me and Brian Tobin wants to hire somebody. And this is 1980s, and he says wants to hire somebody to be the executive secretary for wheelchair tennis. And it was not part of the ITF, it was our own. We had a International Wheelchair Tennis Federation, and it was just these people that came to the U.S. Open from overseas. And we used to start to meet and start to discuss rules and seedings and all this kind of stuff. And so they hire Ellen DeLonga, which I was involved in the hiring of her, me and Doug, and she goes to work for the ITF. So now all of a sudden we have somebody in the ITF offices for wheelchair tennis, and she starts to develop all the international aspects of the sport. We, you know, I gave that all to her to do, you know, Paralympics start to be discussed and being a part of that, and the rules and regulations and just everything just starts to develop. Well, the USTA catches on to that. And we've always, now at this point in time, we have a committee, you know, wheelchair tennis committee, and, you know, Eve, you know, introduced me to everybody. You know, she'd introduce me to the president of I'd go to all these meetings. She'd introduce me to the president of the USTA. She'd introduce me, Philippe Chartier. And, you know, so, and then she would attend all our international meetings, which were at our US Open in Irvine, and advise us. And it just happened organically, really. I mean, I never expected it to happen. I always thought we would just, you know, we'd have a good relationship with these organizations, but I never thought we'd be a part of it. I never pushed for it. It just kind of happened. And then, you know, I think it was 1998. We took that year, we ran the last US Open for our organization. We were planning on putting everything and changing everything over so we would kind of go away and the USTA would take over. And You know, I got asked if I would want to head up that position. And, you know, I didn't want to, only because I'd been doing it for a long time and it was time to kind of pass the torch, so to speak. And, but it took, you know, and then with the USDA, it took years for us to even work our way into it, you know.
Well, that sounds like the USDA. Things take a while for it to materialize. Yeah.
But I can remember like in the early 80s going to Eve and I said, do you think we could do an exhibition at the US Open sometime? Because we were doing exhibitions at Davis Cup matches in those days. But you think we could do one at the US Open? She said, never. That'll never happen. And I said, well,
And now look where we are. Prize money, all four majors.
Yeah.
It's a huge component of, you know, week two. I guess it's now week three. USTA is pushing, you know, it's a 3-week event. Australia, you know, they're doing exhibition matches. They had the big match with Federer on the Saturday before the tournament started. The three of the four majors now start on a Sunday. So that's already become a 15-day. And now they're putting more events leading into it. So, you know, people ask me all the time, and Brad Parks is joining me here on the Tennis Worthy podcast, a man responsible for making wheelchair tennis what it is today. People ask me all the time about, you know, the current top players. How has the game evolved? You know, obviously the speed of the game. You talked a little bit about the technology of the chair. But overall, how has wheelchair tennis changed? Because now, I mean, all these players that are playing at that level are just ridiculous athletes. And has it just gotten better and better over time?
Well, I mean, just think about it. So we're all, I'm newly injured, 18 years old, just out of the hospital. And I start to play in this hospital wheelchair with wooden rackets. And so, you know, I didn't know what I was doing. None of us knew, you know, some of the older timers, when we get together, we talk about how we had no idea what we were doing. Okay, so we're taking, okay, this is how you move a wheelchair to play basketball. Okay, so you do this, you do that, you know, whatever. So I remember thinking and in talking to Jeff about this early on, Jeff Minnebraker, that, you know, in fact, Jeff stressed that, I think, to me before I even realized it. I think it was his idea, which I've never even probably thought about it recently. You have to move with the racket in your hand. So you have to learn to push the wheelchair with the racket in your hand. And Jeff I don't know what I did at first. Maybe I didn't even move, or maybe I stuck it in my lap. Or maybe I tried both, but he told me that. And I'd kind of really forgotten about it until just now. And so that was the big thing. And of course, in the early days, you tear the heck out of your racket, the grip, you know? And so we had to figure out how we work around that. So that was important. But okay, so to move to the backhand, so you got the racket in your hand, for basketball, you would come across your body with your left hand and hit the wheel. So then you have this racket kind of available. So that was a basketball move. So we're trying to do that. And then tennis-wise, okay, so we're just using regular tennis skills. You know, you keep your face towards your opponent. You don't turn your back to the ball, right, and stuff. Of course, now everybody does that. And movement is so different. So it took years for us to figure out even how to really play and what the differences are. And I forget exactly the year, but Randy, I think it was in the early 90s, he and his coach, Bal Moore, who was a great college coach at University in Alabama, and they came up, they started studying it, really studying it. I mean, we're all students of the game. We're all students of the mental game. We're all students of the sport. And I used to read Jack Kramer's books, you know, of how he developed pro tennis and about 10. I mean, I just, read and read and read and learn and try to learn. And, you know, I worked with Vandermeer and Braden and Jim Lear and all these different guys and stuff. And, so Randy's and his coach are watching everybody and learning stuff. And at this point, the chairs started to change a little bit and the mobility started to change. And he wrote this great book. And the way people play today really comes from that book, Myth to Reality Wheelchair Tennis, it was called. And he talked about really the way everybody plays and teaches is really from that book. And it radically changed the game. A guy named Jim Black, who worked for one of the wheelchair companies, great tennis player. He started figuring out where to position, how much camber to put in. We went from like 3 or 4 degrees, 5 degrees of camber to, I don't even know what they are now, but it's really radical camber. And you move the wheels forward, which changes the weight distribution and your balance point. But then you have to put a something on the back to keep you from tipping over. So now all of a sudden you have the two wheels in the front and you have one or two wheels in the back and then smaller ones. And then when that started happening, I remember hitting with Jim just here in San Clemente, and I gotta try this chair. I said, it's crazy. And he was the first one. I mean, nobody else has a chair like this, and nobody's hitting back. You know, everyone hits that crazy.
Well, they create the backhand like that, backhand. Like the reverse. Yeah, the reverse. Yeah.
He started doing that as well. And we always thought that was crazy. He'd just sit in the bag and get balls on two bounces and hit this incredible, powerful backhand, that same backhand. And so these are things that just kind of took years and time, and it just had to develop on its own. Randy's book, Jim's chair design and backhand and these different things just started to progress the sport. And then, it's just changed it. And then today you add in, more improvements, bigger wheels, lighter equipment, the strapping and the seat things that people put in, the molded seats and all this kind of stuff is just, it just continues to improve. And having prize money tournaments where people are focusing on it, I'm sure helps a lot. And they all have coaches. We didn't have coaches. We didn't even have umpires. We called our own rides.
That's okay. My brother didn't have a coach either when he started on the tour at 18, 19. So times have changed. I'm going to ask you, there's another question I'm going to ask you that I always get asked. The greatest of all time. And obviously, as we've both discussed in able-bodied tennis and wheelchair tennis, the technology changes. So the game itself improves just because it has to. But for all you've seen, and you've seen them all, who would you say, in your opinion, the view of Brad Parks, a man who started wheelchair tennis, is the best player you've ever seen?
I think on the men's side, for sure, it's Shingo. Mm-hmm. From Japan, who just retired. This new fella from Japan, Oda, I haven't seen him enough. I really like Gustavo from Argentina. Not as the greatest player ever, but I just like the way he plays. He's a true paraplegic, which is, you don't see so much anymore. In the old days, we had the same, different disabilities, guys who could walk and do stuff like that, but couldn't play wheelchair tennis couldn't play tennis or a sport without a wheelchair. So it, for sure, it's legit. I'm not saying anything about that, but I have to say my favorite all time would have to be Shingo and Esther on the women's side. Esther's record is going to be tough to break. She was amazing, such a pure, true athlete and professional. Both of them are. And that's what I really appreciated. It took years to get to the point where I saw somebody else as a tennis player, because they were really basketball players first, even Randy Snow. It took years before Randy, would say that, yeah, I'm a tennis player. That's my main sport. A lot of these guys were, we started playing tennis and started running tournaments around the basketball schedule. And so it was today to see these guys being tennis players. To me, that is such a big thing for me, because I couldn't wait for that to happen. And I felt like I was the only one who thought that in that way. And years finally start happening. We had this international circuit, players were going around the world competing, and you could tell that they were, but it wasn't uncommon even into the 90s where people were multiple sport athletes. They did track or they did basketball and tennis. So it was, where now it's pretty much tennis. So.
Yeah, as we're preparing up, we at the Tennis Hall of Fame to welcome Roger Federer into the Hall of Fame. Shingo will be another one that will go in when his time comes pretty soon. By the way, Esther Vergeer's speech she gave was one of the all-timers. I was lucky enough to be there in attendance when she got inducted, and her speech was absolutely off the charts. And I think there was not an eye in that place that didn't have a tear or two in their eyes listening to her. All right, before I let you go, and I appreciate all your time, we already have gone over what we talked about. Congrats on your induction already 16 years ago. 2010. What was that day like? Well, before I let you go, just tell our fans what that was like going into the Hall of Fame.
It was amazing. I mean, it was just an amazing experience, you know, just going, just calling people up and telling them when I found out that I was going to go in, you know, calling up, you know, old coaches and old people who were involved in the sport. And you know, the whole experience was pretty surreal. I did, you know, at the time I had no idea they were going to form a, you know, a classification for wheelchair
players. Right. Yeah.
So the whole event's over. We're going to dinner. And I run into Tony, Trabert, and, he's with his, you know, his daughter. Anyway, so he shows me the ring. He says, we're all going to get one of these. And I said, oh, wow, that's beautiful. And, I got the first one and the only one right now. But, and then he says that, you know, we're going to form a, classification for wheelchair tennis, and you're the first one to be inducted. And, you know, of course, when I got inducted, there wasn't a classification. There was just two opportunities. You know, there was the Masters, you know, which they don't have anymore. There was the regular player category. And then there was the contributor category.
Contributor, right. And now we have the wheelchair category.
But there wasn't a wheelchair. And so anyway, so it's been, it was just a wonderful experience. It was amazing. And I remember when Chantal went in a few years later, she asked me if I would represent her. What do you call it?
Introduce her.
Yeah. You know, right. In those days, you know, it was done live and, you know, there in the stadium. So I look back at her when I'm doing this and I said, could you ever have imagined that you and I would be right here today in this place? And honestly, introducing her was just as special to me almost as going in or as you know, doing the whole thing myself. But it was, yeah, it was wonderful. I mean, it was great. It was fun. I mean, there was so many different, it was so different in those way, you know, in those days it was different. Bud Collins was like the MC at one of the dinners. And we all kind of gave a little talk during that impromptu sort of talk. And you know, it was just different, but it was fantastic. It was great. I am actually coming this year, so I'm looking forward to coming. Yeah, and being a part of that and going to the U.S. Open afterwards for the 50-year kind of celebration. And then we have an event down in Orlando at the USTA headquarters, you know, for the International World Team Cup for wheelchair tennis. So, yeah, it'll be great to be a part of all that and looking forward to I know the ceremony now is actually on those beautiful courts at the entrance, right?
Yes, the horseshoe courts. Yeah, and then we opened up the stadium for tickets because of the guy by the name of Mr. Federer. So those sold out in less than 2 minutes, or, you know, 4,000 plus seats.
I had heard that, and I was not surprised. But
me neither, no.
You know, but it sure makes the whole induction ceremony, I think, even more special because of what they're doing, you know, the way it's changed and the way it's being done now. It's its own event now, which I think is amazing. And that's, I guess, what it should be. So,
well, we'll look forward to seeing you in August, late August at the International Tennis Hall of Fame. The great Brad Parks, everyone, on the Tennis Worthy podcast. Thank you.
Thank you, Pat. Great being with you.